This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/sword. That's audiblepodcast.com/sword.
Is part of the Frog Pants Studios Network. For more information about this and other shows, visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.
Episode number 94. I'm Veronica Belmont.
And I'm Tom Merritt.
And this is the audio podcast where we talk about some of our favorite things happening in the science fiction and fantasy world, discuss the books we are currently reading, and talk about what you guys are all talking about over in the Goodreads forums.
The audio podcast, you say? Yeah, that is what this is. Audio delivered to your ears for your oral enjoyment.
Straight to your ears for your oral pleasure.
A-U.
So we kick off this show every week with a little segment we like to call "What Are We Drinking?" And I notice that both of us are drinking Syrahs this evening.
Everyone else hates that we call it that, but we like to call it that. Okay, so
we're the only ones who care what we are actually drinking,
and we've been drinking. No,
let me tell you.
No, I'm not. I'm not drunk.
I
or am I
not drunk? I'm not drunk on this because it's not very good.
Oh, I've had your Lagranja Syrah before.
Is it La Granja? See, because it's Spanish, I was going to say La Granja.
Oh, maybe it is La Granja. You're probably right. And
but I
I'm
know if
ashamed
that would sound
because I took
pretentious.
Spanish for like 8 years.
I think it's kind of watery.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Did you get it from Trader Joe's? I know they have it at Trader Joe's.
$3.99, Trader Joe's. Can't beat that.
Yeah.
So for $3.99, I'm not going to get too harsh on it, but not my favorite.
Not your favorite? Okay, well, I am also drinking a Syrah, which isn't bad, actually. It's a Paso
Syrah.
Robles Syrah, and it is from a Zeppelin.
What?
It's from a Zeppelin.
It's steampunk Syrah?
It is steampunk Syrah. It is from a Zeppelin trip that a thwarted Zeppelin trip, I might add, that your wife was also thwarted.
I was
gonna
say,
from going on.
I don't have any Paso Robles Syrah from a Zeppelin, and my wife was there.
She didn't get a bottle?
Oh, I bet she did.
Maybe
she did, and I don't even realize it's there.
Yeah, we got two bottles. They're tiny bottles. They're small.
They're like half bottles. So she probably drank it on the ride home.
That's entirely possible. It was in the middle of the day, so it's a good time for drinking
didn't drive,
a tiny bottle
she didn't
of Syrah.
Drive, okay.
No, she just had to drive back to Petaluma. I mean, it's really not that far from Oakland, so it was fine, I'm sure.
It's fine.
I'm sure it's fine. But anyway, let's move on to the part of the actual show, which we like to call the Quick Burns.
Oh, Quick Burns. You burn so quickly, and you're full of maps today. The Wart Zone loves to tell you about a good Song of Ice and Fire map. And wow, do they have a good one to tell you about. Sarah Mountain Goat has created a new world map for a Song of Ice and Fire, inspired by the previous superb map of Westeros that we talked about. This one has even got George R. R. Martin saying, wow, the map's accuracy is pretty damn good.
Nice. Yeah, wow, the Dothraki Sea is huge. It's huge, but like actually seeing it next to everything else is pretty mind-blowing. It's basically as long as Westeros is tall, I guess, lengthwise.
He was inspired by the one that they used to make the HBO series, and then he went beyond. And yeah, it's a full on square. You're right. It's as tall as it is wide, and it's got everything, and it's gorgeous.
Yeah,
absolutely gorgeous.
No, I just meant specifically the Dothraki Sea itself is.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, you're right.
As large as the kingdom of Westeros,
it is like Russia with Siberia added on. It's huge, and it just goes on forever.
You can see the summer islands down there too.
Mm-hmm.
I never really thought about where they were.
And the Red Waste fully integrated. Like, you see the entire red waste on this map.
I love that.
And George R. R. Martin has signed up. Like, yeah, that's pretty right.
He's like, yeah, I can see that.
I totally made that.
And also, in other map news, we have a map of the United States over on IO9 drawn in the style of Lord of the Rings.
This is pretty crazy because what he did is he took the book Nine Nations of North America by Joel Garreau as his inspiration. So he's not trying to create all the states. He creates countries based around those nine nations. And that book, Nine Nations of North America, actually I used as inspiration for my book, Boiling Point. Mm-hmm. And it posits that we are more similar to those in our cultural area than we are to each other across the United States, whether we're in Mexico, Canada, the United States, Cuba, or wherever. So he posits, you know, Mex-America in the main part of Mexico up into the southwest of the United States. He posits the factory belt, et cetera. And so this map is just the United States, but it names California as Mex-America. It names Texas as this sort of, you know, southwest
nation. Yeah, encompassing Louisiana and Texas. And then we have Dixie, which is the larger part of the South. And then New England, which rightfully so, takes up most of the East Coast of the country.
Yeah, you guys went and conquered New York.
I always thought we should have conquered New York anyway.
So. And Ohio.
I'm happy to see this. And New Jersey. Anyway, yeah, we took over the tri-state area as well.
We're kind of burying the lead here, though, because I'm geeking out about the Nine Nations, because it's written in the same style that both Tolkien's, Christopher and J.R.R.R., made their maps. So it's got this ancient feel of this is where the hobbits would be.
Yeah, I like it. I think it would make a good poster.
It would make an excellent poster. I agree.
And we also have some info on Guy Gavriel Kay's new novel. This is also coming from the Wart Zone. Guy Gavriel Kay has released some info on his new novel, following up on 2010's well-received Under Heaven. As Adam says on the blog, his new novel will retain the Chinese-style setting of his previous book, but will this time be based around the Song Dynasty. Adam goes on to say that it sounds like the book will be set in the same world as Under Heaven, but four centuries later. Now, did you read that book?
I didn't. I'm not very well versed in Guy Gavriel Kay, but having read this description of the upcoming book, I'm much more interested.
Just another one to add to the list.
I know, like I'll ever have time.
The always growing list.
And us going to speed up.
Going to speed up?
We're going to speed up the number of books. Soon.
Yes, that is true, actually. Yes, you are correct, sir. Just slightly. Just maybe a week shorter in the rotation.
Yeah.
I would say. So tell me about the worst science fiction novel of the 19th century, Tom.
Well, let me tell you. This is on IO9. It's by Jess Nevins. Walter Besant's The Inner House, Joseph Nicholson's Thoth, and H.G. Wells' Time Machine are often thought to be grand literature of the 19th century, but the good novels are far outnumbered by the bad ones, according to Jess Nevins. Jess puts forth an entirely new feature of a thrilling novel entitled The Social War of the Year 1900, or Conspirators and Lovers, A Lesson for Saints and Sinners. That is the entire name of the novel as possibly the worst science fiction novel of the 19th century.
And so what makes it so bad exactly? Is it the prose? Yeah, Jess says that part of the problem is the prose style. Though published in 1872, The Social War reads as if it were written 40 years earlier. Well, this sounds kind of Lemmish to me.
The horses ran furiously away, semicolon. Victor sprang back to the coach and with the strength of a giant rolled the equipage aside, which relieved the sire, semicolon. But, oh, horror! There was the most gloriously beautiful daughter for whom the sire prayed for a safe deliverance, dead to all appearances, semicolon. Quickly, Victor Juno raised her to his arms and, being a physician, took a small vial from his pocket and placed to her lips a few drops of unfermented vegetable liquid, which immediately caused slight signs of life.
Sire, cried Victor Juno, shall I take the liberty to do my utmost? I am a physician to restore your daughter.
The Social War is about the conflict between the American society.
Oh, come on, I wanted
society.
You to keep going. We were
going
to do some audio fiction here.
I thought we might kill people
here.
Like we were doing Vogue on poetry.
But we make it, I think we could really do some justice to this piece. But
$10,000 and an everlasting indebtedness to you, sire, for her restoration, responded the old gentleman.
I'll save her without dollars or indebtedness, or I am not a normal naturalist, ejaculated Victor Juno.
The hero now speedily removes the jewels, satins, and silks from her swan-like neck and Venus chest, and applies his powerfully magnetic hand upon the nape of the neck, and centering his giant will into his fingers, sends messengers of grace to the nervous center of the prostrate form of the loveliest of her kind. And in a moment, Miss Lucinda Armington opened her eyes and gave a benignant look into the fiery and heaven-inspired eyes of our hero, and thus the life of the one became the joy and resurrection of the other.
I think this sounds perfect for I think this could be kind of saucy.
Yeah, there's I think
it's got a little bit of that Victorian era, you know, bodice ripper going on here.
But
I think if you go further
with it. Horribly written. As I was going to say before we got sucked back into the drama, it is about the conflict between the American Society and the Naturalists, a military secret society led by Victor Juno, who is a physician who believes in using animal magnetism rather than medicine.
See, I told you, it's a total bodice ripper.
You're totally right. Anyway, it's the loosest form of 19th century sci-fi and really, really bad. I mean, it didn't even keep the tense straight.
Yeah, I noticed that. Even I noticed that. Mm. That's all right. Well, in sad news, French artist Mobius, the man who made The Abyss, Alien, and Tron even weirder, according to IO9, has passed away at age 73.
Yeah, Mobius, some of science fiction's most amazing artwork. If you have enjoyed Alien or Tron, the original Tron, Masters of the Universe, The Fifth Element, Willow, you have enjoyed the work of Jean Giraud, Mobius. So sad to see him go.
Yes, we've had a lot of great people pass away recently in the science fiction fantasy world. So stop that already.
Stop dying. It's science fiction and fantasy. You're supposed to have immortal elixirs and robot bodies. Come on.
And animal magnetism.
And use your animal magnetism.
Use it better. Initiate timeline sequence. All right, so let's read down in the calendar. So on March 13th, which is Tuesday, tomorrow, or today, depending on when you're listening to the show, we have Raymond E. Feist's A Crown Imperiled, book two of the Chaos War Saga. We've talked about that a little bit. We also have Shoebox Trainwreck by John Mantooth and Danny Evarts, and Autumn Aftermath by David Moody. I don't think we've talked about that one too much.
No, I just added this one to the calendar. It is a sequel. In fact, I think it may be the last in a series, but it's very zombie-oriented if you're into the zombies.
Ah, fabulous.
Yeah. It's been 100 days since a killer disease wiped out 99% of the population sort of book. March 27th, Fair Coin by E.C. Myers, 16-year-old Ephraim Scott, horrified, comes home from school, finds his mother unconscious. We've talked about this one before. Ephraim finds a strange coin that grants wishes, and of course he flips it. Rest would be spoilers. And Body Ink by Alan Dean Foster, coming out March 27th as well. In a world deeply wounded by centuries of environmental damage, two unlikely souls join forces. Dr. Ingrid Seastrom has stumbled into a mystery involving quantum entangled nanoscale implants, a mystery that just may kill her.
Oh, snap. And then on March 31st, we have Indomitable by Terry Brooks and Mauricio Manzieri. Master fantasist Terry Brooks first conjured the unforgettable world of the magic Rakt IV lands more than three decades ago, and its boundaries continue to expand into new territory. With Indomitable, Brooks provides an essential epilogue to the beloved Shannara trilogy that started it all.
Wow, Shannara trilogy.
Nice. That's,
yeah. And April 3rd, just looking a little farther down the road. Yeah, that's right. We're almost April. Nocturnal by Scott Sigler. Something lives deep beneath the streets of San Francisco. Something that has been there for centuries. Something that comes out at night to feed on the dregs of society.
Problem?
It's probably Muni drivers.
Why is that a problem? It's feeding on the dregs of society.
It's not Muni drivers. A subculture with its own myths, its own legends of a leader named the King that will lead them out of bondage, and their own demon, a hunting shadow known only as the Savior.
Muni drivers make more money than other drivers around the country, you know.
Than hunting shadow demons.
Also more than them. It's true.
It's true.
And then also on the 3rd, we have The Road of Danger, Lieutenant Leary, part of the Lieutenant Leary series, I'm assuming, by David Drake. It's number 9 in the national best-selling RCN space adventure series. Captain Daniel Leary with his friend and spy, Officer Adele Mundy, are sent to a quiet sector to carry out an easy task.
Yeah, boring book.
helping the local admiral put down a coup before it takes place. But then the jealous admiral gets rid of them by sending them off on a wild goose chase to a sector where commerce is king and business is carried out by extortion and gunfights.
I know that David Drake isn't everybody's taste, but those who love him are pretty passionate about him, so they've got to be pretty excited about this.
I have to admit, I'm not too familiar with his work. So I feel like maybe I should get to know him a little better.
Go meet David Drake. He's a good guy.
Okay. Maybe we can get him on the show sometime.
Hear that, David Drake?
Talk about his national best-selling series that, unfortunately, I stupidly know nothing about. All right, well, let's move on to Barrier Sword, which is our feedback from the audience. And this is a good topic that we've kind of discussed a little bit on the show before, and also with some of the authors we've had on the show. This comes to us from Tone, who writes, "I'm no expert, but it seems that the baby boomer geeks liked their sci-fi hard and their fantasy light on the destiny. But if I touch a genre book written in the last 30 years, I have to be careful not to catch a destiny plot hook. Maybe baby boomers felt they were destined to save the world, so their fantasies were more personal. And Generation X grew up thinking that they didn't matter, so we like our heroes to be messiah figures. If so, what does the millennial generation like in a hero? I know you guys were brought up on Harry Potter, but now you're adults, so what's your thing? This is our Gen X sci-fi fantasy fans fixated on The Chosen One."
This is an interesting, premise that Tone is putting out there. I'm not so sure that generations are as responsible for this sort of thing as the times themselves. Mm-hmm. So he makes a good logical argument. It's like, hey, Generation X generally thought to feel like they don't care or like they aren't cared about. So maybe that's why they would look for a savior, et cetera, et cetera. I do think it's more tied into at times where things feel hopeful. You generally see a chosen one, and times when things feel desperate, you see darker, but we're kind of seeing darker and hope and chosen one at the same time. So I'm not sure what that means.
Yeah, no, this is very interesting. I'm actually not sure what generation I belong to. I'm supposed to know that.
I think you're probably Y.
Why? That's what I have always kind of thought. But
I'm firmly X.
That seems so nebulous. Like, I don't really know what that means.
I'm as X as they get. Why millennials? I don't know. You're not a millennial, though.
No, I think I'm too old for millennial.
Yeah.
Anyway, it doesn't matter. But I like the answer that Joe came up with. He said, "I think George Lucas basically made the Campbellian hero's journey the go-to story for genre movies, and a whole lot of authors grew up on Star Wars."
That could be.
And Tolkien cast such a huge shadow over the epic fantasy genre, and the hero's journey is so easily overlaid on the superficial aspects of Lord of the Rings, even though Frodo is not the kind of messiah slash chosen one you see in later genre stories. So a lot of authors basically rewrite Star Wars and Lord of the Rings over and over again.
Yeah, I still hold to the idea that that the mood of the culture at the time mm-hmm. causes the desire for the type of fantasy sci-fi, because we're all looking for escape when we read this stuff, right? So if we're hopeful, it's going to be all about, you know, flying out to the stars and conquering the world. And you see that in Star Trek in the 1960s, mm-hmm. when we were still very hopeful that, you know, we're coming out of the 50s where, you know, post-war and everything's going to be great. And then it quickly, even within Star Trek, mm-hmm. you see it turn, and they're dealing with racism and they're dealing with war and all of that. And I think that has a lot to do with the fact that over the past 30 years, we've seen a cynicism for enlightened leadership. And so it's not just economics that causes the effect on the literature. I think it's more our cynicism about our leaders and about where the world is headed that is making us want fantasy, where there's finally that one hero, that one person who gets it. And maybe they're, you know, that Arthurian sort of metaphor is what underpins it, because it's somebody you wouldn't expect. It's not the establishment.
Well, so what do you think is the cause for the recent trend of, the very postmodern style epic fantasy that's a lot darker that we've discussed in great detail on the show? Do you think that's just something of a thing of the time, like people being tired of the same kind of fantasy stories, the epic fantasy chosen one tales, where they have to kind of dirty it up a little bit?
Yeah, and part of it, and when you put it that way, it makes me think, well, it's not always just the mood of the society as much as it is a reaction to the previous types of literature. We get kind of tired of reading the same kinds of stuff, and so we want a new take on it. And the new take is like, hey, you know, for 20 years you had happy fairies and wizards and tall hats and, you know, romping through the meadow. And now I'm going to bring a little reality to it. I'm going to bring a little gangster into it.
Nobody's
done that.
Nice. And then another great discussion topic that's been going on was started by Mike. And this thread is called Political Views of Authors. It gets a little heated, folks. He says, I've noticed that many folks here use particular groups of political / social / moral views of an author as either positive or negative in reference to their work. Many times in particular, I've read people argue against reading a book because of conservative, quote, views, or recommend a good book but excuse the conservative views of the author. I'm wondering why people do that. Isn't art supposed to be infused with an expression of the author, whether or not we like it? I will admit to holding particular views on particular issues that people would classify as conservative, and maybe that is why this has really come to my attention. However, I enjoy reading authors that wildly disagree with my views, particularly political or philosophical. Gosh, it's that word again. I had so much a hard time with it the other day, too. Philosophical issues, as I find it sets the tone in the novel and gets me thinking about something in a way I probably never thought about before. Interestingly, I wonder what the reaction would be from folks here if I argued against the liberal views of some author. Would it be valid to recommend a book to someone here but excuse the liberal views of the author? Just thought I would throw this out for discussion. Remember, we are all common book lovers here. Smiley face.
The only thing I don't like about Mike's post is that he brings it to be about himself and his conservative views. And I have seen people go after authors for having liberal views. And I have seen people say, you know what, that person is just trying to grind their axe of pro-gay rights or something like that. Mm-hmm. You do see that on these forums. So this isn't a they're always after the conservatives or they're always after the liberals. But if we take that out of it, I think Mike does make a really good point where folks do get drawn into saying, wow, I found out that this author has a viewpoint that I don't agree with, and I loved their book. So obviously the viewpoint, whether it was in the book or not, didn't bother you when you read it, but I'm not sure I can support them anymore. And I think that that comes from this idea of, oh, I'm not going to shop at that store anymore because I found out that they support SOPA.
Child labor or child labor
or whatever. You know, voting with your dollars is a widely practiced way of protest. And that gets mixed in. And so it's not just about do I read and enjoy the story? It's about do I support this author? Maybe by giving them money for buying the book, but even if I borrow it from a library, am I thereby promoting that author by, you know, saying, hey, library, this book is popular. I read it. Do I tell people, hey, I really like the story and promote them that way? And I agree with Mike in the end that it should really be about the story, whether you liked the story or not. But I also understand why people might, if they very, very definitely disagree with something or they find out something about an author that they just cannot tolerate, liberal or conservative, it doesn't really matter to me. I can respect them saying, you know what, I really would like to like their stories, but while they're alive, I don't want to encourage that viewpoint. I think it's pretty rare, for me anyway, that an author is going to have some element or some viewpoint that is so extreme that I would actually feel like I just can't support them that way.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people feel that way as well. I in fact, do agree with you strongly on that. But Nick and Rob both jumped in. Rob went on to say, the real issue generally is not what views an author may have, but if the presentation of those views interfere with good storytelling, as you said. Does, for example, J.K. Rowling's stated atheism affect the quality of the story she weaves, or does her lack of Christianity make the novels any less appealing? Would the Potterverse be more engaging if it had God? The other possible issue could be tangentially related, which is when an author uses a book to push a personal agenda. Perhaps the story is a good one, but even a moderately enlightened reader can spot the propaganda where it occurs. The question then becomes, should we give money to this individual who expresses these ideas? And I am of the viewpoint that it's tough because there's a lot of authors who I know I don't agree with their politics, but oftentimes I've read their stories before I've come to discover that particular fact. And other times I have known an author's political leanings, and then it has gone on to affect in some ways my enjoyment of the literature when I go on to read it. So I've seen it affect me, for sure. But I think it just comes down to your personal choice. You know, you may be missing out on a great story if you choose to not support an author whose views you disagree with. But at the same time, if you feel that strongly about an issue, you're doing yourself a disservice by tangentially supporting that cause, I guess, by purchasing the products.
By supporting something you don't feel comfortable supporting, and you don't want to be seen as supporting it, maybe.
Right.
Yeah, and I think you need to make that distinction if you're discussing something. Based on what we both said here, and I think you brought up some really good points, Veronica, there are sort of three reactions. One is, I liked the story. Maybe I don't agree with everything that the author believes in, but it doesn't matter. So I'm just not going to bring that into it. Mm-hmm. Two is, I didn't like the story because the story brought in things that I disagree with. I have no idea whether the author agrees with them or not. Maybe they're just telling a story that way, but I don't like that story because it promotes X. Mm-hmm. I think that's a valid viewpoint. And then three is, you know what? I did like the story, but I have found out this horrible thing, how this author believes that everyone should be killed who is over the age of 20. And has red hair. And I find that intolerable. And so I can't support them. So therefore, I am not going to read any more of their stories, even though they are good, while that person lives. And, you know, I don't want to be seen as supporting them. And I don't think conservative or liberal has anything to do with it. Because if you are conservative, as Mike is, you're going to be more sensitive to people criticizing folks with your kinds of belief. And if you're a liberal, you're going to be more sensitive to people criticizing those who share your beliefs. But the fact of the matter is, there's always going to be folks out there on one side or the other 500 sides in between, who are uncomfortable with someone saying, hey, I don't like that author because he believes or she believes in X.
Mm-hmm. Well, needless to say, it goes into a long discussion about Orson Scott Card.
Well, he's one of the very polarizing figures. He's one of the best examples of this, whatever side you come down on, because of his stated beliefs. And he is one where I don't agree with him at all. But at the same time, I don't feel like reading an Orson Scott Card novel compromises my principles. And some people do, and I respect that. But to me, I don't feel like he's enough of a force with his views to...
Well, it depends on what you're reading. If you're reading some of his personal essays or his rewrite of Hamlet, I mean, things get a little... Well, sure. I don't want to jump. They get a little dicey.
Yeah, and if those had more of an effect and more people were talking about them, I might change my mind. Mm-hmm. But I don't feel like saying, hey, read Ender's Game actually advances any of those other things he believes. Yeah, so I draw a line there. There's also, I mean, we meet a lot of authors, and every author we've met has been absolutely fantastic. But there might be a case in which we meet an author who's an actual jerk, you know? And mm-hmm. Is that going to change if I really like what he wrote? You know?
I don't think we've ever... Never mind.
No, it...
I'm laughing inwardly at a joke from something, so don't worry about it. Some of you may know what I'm giggling about.
We've been lucky that, you know, all of the authors that we've interviewed have been exactly what they appeared in our shows.
Yes. Yes. They've stayed within their box,
yeah.
I would say. All right, so let's talk about some TV, movies, and video games. Game of Thrones is about to drop. It is about to drop on us, on our heads, on April 1st. No joke. And all the season 2 episode stuff is pouring out. And yeah, I know, we're probably going to have to start doing the post-show. But not yet, because the show hasn't started yet. So we can still talk about Game of Thrones.
There are trailers upon trailers upon trailers out there.
Yes, indeed you do.
There's another one this week with more scenes of Daenerys, more scenes of Cersei, more interactions between Joffrey and other characters. So go check it out. There's also a listing from the Wart Zone of the episode titles for many of the episodes of Game of Thrones this season.
Mm-hmm. All right, so we're looking at The North Remembers, episode 201, 202, The Night Lands, 203, What Is Dead May Never Die. I think I know what may come from that. Number 204, Garden of Bones. Number 205, The Ghost of Harrenhal.
Aha, I know what that is too.
206, Old Gods and the New. Mm-hmm. 207 doesn't have a title yet. And then, of course, nothing else has a title except for 209, Blackwater.
Well, we know what that is if you read
the
book.
Yes, we do. Too. Written by George R. Martin, which is going to be freaking awesome. I actually have that episode in my calendar just to make sure I don't miss
the Blackwater episode. Nice.
Yeah.
It's the only thing that and True Blood, frankly, are the only things keeping me subscribed to cable right now.
Oh, interesting. Really you don't like, well, cable. You don't watch Walking Dead?
I can get Walking Dead. I can get it like legally in other ways. I can buy it, download it. HBO never makes their stuff available for purchase.
You don't use HBO Go? Oh, you have to have HBO.
You have to have a subscription to HBO to use HBO Go.
You have to do that a la carte. That's driving me crazy.
I know. Speaking of driving people crazy, those who didn't get into the beta for Pottermore have been waiting forever.
Aww.
And apparently they finally worked out all of the problems, all of the overloads, all of the server hangups, and it's set to release in April. So if you're interested in more Harry Potter than you can shake a unicorn's horn at, check it out. Pottermore is coming in April.
And then we also have a, I'm getting a little echo from your end. I don't know what's causing that. Do you have headphones on?
I don't.
You don't? You don't have headphones on?
No.
So how are you hearing me?
Over the bleed.
Really? You're listening to me over your computer speakers?
Are you getting the echo now?
No.
Okay.
Check, check, check. Yeah, a little bit. Well, hopefully the audience doesn't mind too much. Maybe they like hearing twice as me. Twice of me. Jeremiah made a post about Mass Effect. He says, so I was thinking on this today, put aside the discussion of Mass Effect series as games. Put aside the game dynamics and consider Mass Effect as a piece of storytelling. Consider on that point, I have to say that it is rather brilliant. It deals with some really heady concepts, such as the true definition of intelligent life, the nature of free will, the egocentric way we look at ourselves, and all of that embedded in a high adventure epic story. The presentation of characters reflects a range of not found in a lot of media. The level detail is deep enough that we can't know it all, which is nice for verisimilitude. All in all, I say it's everything I would want a sci-fi series to be. Am I alone in thinking in that light? Sadly, the actual novels set in the world are not as well told as the games. They're not terrible, but they're not really outstanding either.
Andrew and Zach are the only other people who've weighed in on this thread, but I'd like to hear if there's anybody else out there what they think, because I've been reading online, a lot of people are upset at the ending of Mass Effect 3.
I haven't beaten it yet, so
and I'm not going to say anything about the ending. No, I'm not going to say anything about the ending, but there are people demanding that they change the ending to Mass Effect 3.
Wow.
Which I think is crazy. A, because how are they going to go change an ending? I guess you could issue a patch. But B, people are so into this story that if it's not what they wanted, they are going to rise up against it and say, no.
I've had people already tell me, like, because we reviewed it on Game On this week and I haven't beaten it yet. And I said in the beginning of the show, caveat, I have not beaten the game yet. I'm taking my dear sweet time with it on purpose because I want to do everything. And this is like a review in progress. You know, it's my feelings thus far. And people were like, well, that's great, but you're going to hate the ending. And I was like, I am?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, you're going
to hate
the ending.
That seems to be the prevailing wisdom, I know.
And people who claim to know me and my feelings on things, which is probably, you know, pretty accurate, were like, yeah, you're going to be really upset. I was like, okay. Now it makes me feel kind of bummed out about playing the game. It has already kind of changed my feeling on it.
Although it may do you a favor when you get to the ending, you may not be nearly as outraged because you may go, oh, well, that wasn't as bad as I expected.
I hope so. One can only hope. But I agree with everything Jeremiah says. I think that the series stands alone. I love the writing in 2. I think 2 had some of the strongest writing in a video game I've seen in a very long time, probably just short of Uncharted. But this game, some of the dialogue is a little cringeworthy. Like, I think the writing has done a really good job, but at the same time, there's some character interactions and I'm just like, cringe. So, I don't know. I guess I'll talk more about it once I finish. I don't want to give any spoilers or anything.
Well, let's check in on our current book.
Okay, I'm still not that much further, I have to say.
I am almost two-thirds through.
Two-thirds, wow. Okay.
With our Gentlemen Bastards and the Copper Barsavi, and I am absolutely taken with it. I know there are people on the forums who are disappointed with it, who said they didn't like it.
Really?
I haven't read too many of the forum postings because I don't want to be spoiled until I finish. But I've seen a few headlines come across in the feed saying, yeah, not what I expected, not what I wanted. Now, I know there's plenty of people out there who say they liked it too, but I am absolutely enamored with this world. And it took me a while to get into it. I, you know, I had to learn all the characters and everything. But once I got in, I don't feel it's as gritty and realistic as a Patrick Rothfuss or a George R.R. Martin, but it definitely has some of that depth of world to it. Mm-hmm. And I think probably what a lot of people may not like is the fact that Locke Lamora and the Gentleman Bastards are, they're not paper characters, but they are sort of, you know, they're con men. Mm-hmm. They're full of glib phrases, and therefore, because they are con men, they're not terribly deep. You don't have these like tortured souls with mm-hmm. their depth of character. And I think some people want that. They want Locke Lamora with this horrible upbringing and this history to be a much more twisted, tortured and real character than he is. But frankly, even though he's not, I'm still enjoying it.
I love their interactions so far. I love how they talk. I'm getting a huge kick out of it. It reminds me of some of the funnier lines from the Joe Abercrombie books, actually, in a lot of ways. I'm kind of enjoying the way they curse, the way they carry on together, the way they bust each other's balls. I think it's enjoyable for me to read. It's a nice mood shift from some of the other stuff we've been reading.
Yeah, I like the Woody Dell. In fact, it reminds me of the Social Network, right? Mm-hmm. Where it's, you know, okay, that's not the best telling of the story of Facebook, but boy, they have some snappy dialogue.
Yeah, and,
you know,
snappy dialogue.
Or Ocean's 11, where uh-huh. it's like, yeah, okay, this isn't a deep, you know, meaningful movie. It's not the best role George Clooney ever had, but it's fun.
Yeah.
And I feel like Liza Locke Lamora is definitely got more substance to it than Ocean's 11, but you could still enjoy something because it's snappy, mm-hmm. even if it isn't as deep as maybe you would like.
Absolutely. So I'm still reading along. I'm also, you know, at the same time reading Slave to Sensation, which is another book.
Oh, is that from Vaginal Fantasy?
It is for Vaginal Fantasy.
Okay.
And I have to say, spoiler alert, it is not a very good book. I've been spoiled by you guys because I have pretty high tolerance for, like, you know, bad romance novels. And this uh-huh. one is just like, wow, the writing is just so bad. But this is a discussion for a different book club. But I just want to say, I know there's some overlap in the audience. So if you're following along with Vaginal Fantasy, Slave to Sensation is, it's definitely got some of the sexiness we were looking for. But on the writing end of things, not holding water.
Too much of a slave to the sensation.
Yep.
I am almost to the end of Blue Remembered Earth.
Oh, good.
By Alistair Reynolds. And absolutely adoring it.
Great.
And in many, many ways. I love the projected world that he has created that is so much better than the normal, like, well, we had an environmental apocalypse and now everybody wears leaves. You know, humanity did have an environmental problem and they barely made it out, and they made it out not unscathed and not in a perfect society, but it's an interesting society, and it's a kind of society I could totally see possibly happening. Also, you can't just jet around the universe because you developed warp drive. When they go to Mars, it takes a long time to go to Mars. Because you know what? It takes a long time to go to Mars. So I'm getting the spaceships I was looking for, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
That's great. I am more than halfway done with The Coldest War by Ian Tregellis. And I'm also loving it. I think I'm going to finish that before anything else, actually. It's a fast listen.
You know, Gretel is someone to keep an eye on in that book.
Dude, Gretel is, pardon my French, she is fucking so much shit up right now.
Oh,
she is just like,
you don't even know the half of it.
Oh my, well, I just had the scene with her and Liv in the hospital. And I was like, whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It doesn't
you
get
bitch.
Any, it doesn't get any better. But Ian go blow your mind at the end with Gretel, let me just say.
Oh God, dude, she is just such an evil thing. What a pure...
I can't wait for you to finish the book.
Oh man. Okay. Maybe we'll have Ian back on the show at some point.
Yeah, we should.
Like to, you know, talk his ear off about
this
book.
Well, it's coming out in print in the summer, so
oh great. Perfect timing.
Yeah.
So anyway, let's move on to some emails. We have one from Matt who writes in, "Hey guys, I'm very pleased you're currently reading The Lies of Locke Lamora. I read it about a year ago and immediately followed up with the awesome sequel, Red Seas Under Red Skies." Excuse me. I had to burp. too much Syrah. It was that book that got me more into the fantasy genre, and as I explored online, I found your podcast. I saw this recent post on Scott Lynch's blog regarding some of his early development of the Gentleman Bastard series, and thought it would be interesting to mention on your show. I found this post particularly interesting, as I will be taking part in this year's NaNoWriMo, inspired by your attempts last year, and I plan on making extensive notes beforehand. Keep up the good work, Matt. Yeah, attempts is right. I still haven't finished yet, so I'll get there. So this is a bit of a read-along bonus that Scott Lynch has been writing over on his live journal.
From March 11th of this year.
What is with fantasy authors sticking with the live journal long after its heyday?
Now, just scanning this, I don't know if you want to read all of it,
because
I'm not sure there might be some spoilers in here.
Okay.
And the Falconer was originally called Marek.
That's okay, I'm not even there yet, so.
Yeah, you'll meet him.
All right, cool. Well, thanks, Matt. Also, we have another letter from Christoph. He of the he wrote his master's thesis on William Gibson, Neuromancer, and other
cyberpunk.
Cyberpunk. Thank you. Why couldn't I think of the word cyberpunk? I wanted to say
it's the Syrah.
Yes. And the burping. He writes in, "Hi, this is Chris from Poland again. I wanted to mention that the Discworld Reading Order Guide that I maintain, and which you mentioned once on the podcast, has been updated to version 2.1 and is available on the Discworld Fanatics website. Since you sometimes mention Pratchett, your listeners might want to take a look at the new guide."
Yeah, in fact, I just noticed today when I was updating the calendar that Dodger, which is the next Terry Pratchett novel, finally has a little bit of a description on the pre-order page, which I've copied over to the listing for it. September 25th, 2012 is the release date for that. So check that out. And yes, love talking about the Pratchett. So thanks, Chris. Discworldfanatics.co.uk. Check it out for the reading guide.
Yeah, and he's got a great... this guide is just phenomenal. I mean, it shows you all the different branches of the Discworld tree. You see the Tiffany Aching, the Moise von Lipwig series, the witches novels, the wizards novels, the science novels, the watch novels, the death novels, ancient civilizations, industrial revolution. So many different stories all intertwined. You can see how they all connect. It's very, very cool. So thanks again, Christoph. That's great. Thank you for letting us know.
Thanks, Chris.
Well, should we say hello to some new members?
We do. We have a more manageable amount since we've, not gone so long since our last episode.
Yes, say hello to Amy.
David.
Clarissa.
Jesse.
Todd.
Rob.
Chris.
Ewan.
Jenny.
Don.
Andrew.
Jake.
Bradford.
Jerry.
Binary Bookworm.
Luke.
Billy.
Steven.
Diego.
Jedediah.
Martin.
Andrew.
Stuart.
And Christos.
Huzzah! Well, we are at the end of the show, but we wanted to let you know that we are going to be at WonderCon next weekend. We have a panel at 2 p.m. with Felicia Day, Will Wheaton, and more.
Will there be Guinness? Because it's St. Patrick's Day that we're doing this panel, March 17th.
I do hope so.
And I know Will Wheaton is a fan of the Guinness, as I have seen at Woodstock.
Well, maybe we'll have to buy some and bring some into the panel.
Maybe we should.
Felicia cannot hold her liquor though, so we'll have to.
She can hold it. It's when she drinks it that apparently
that's the problem.
Right? I was hearing on your last vaginal fantasy, she doesn't keep it around the house.
No, she's always like, "I don't drink," and I'm like, "Yes, you do. Why do you keep saying that? It's a lie." Yeah. So that's going to be in room 204, I believe. Let me double check on that. Yes, room 204. It's going to be. Yeah, so check it out. It's all the info is over on the WonderCon website if you want to check it out. And we are very excited to be heading down there. We have bookmarks to give away. And I'm hoping we can get some like photographs and stuff to print out or posters or something. This is all a work in progress for me. I'm trying to figure it out. But we've had some offers from the audience of people who are willing to do some fan art stuff. So I was thinking maybe we'll do some kind of like poster competition or
very cool. Yeah, I love that.
Something fun because we really want to get you guys involved and we need all the help we can get. So there's that too. And yeah, so we're very excited to head down there. It's going to be next weekend. We get in on Saturday and then take off on Sunday.
This weekend.
This coming weekend. Yep. So Saturday and Sunday, and that's it.
Yep.
Yep.
So if you're in the LA area and you have a WonderCon badge or can get a WonderCon badge, check it out.
Yeah, it's We'd down in Anaheim, actually, but it's basically LA also.
Don't tell the Anaheim people.
Don't tell them that. All right, if you want to get in touch with us, the email address is feedback@swordandlaser.com. The web address is swordandlaser.com. All of our discussions happen over at goodreads.com. And if you want to call and leave us a voicemail, the phone number is 415-779-6735. I forgot to check the voicemail, so maybe some of you have called. I promise I'll check for next time.
We promise.
We promise.
Really.
See you guys soon.
Bye.